Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. If you came to my home for dinner and I served you foie gras, what would you think? Would you lick your lips and say, yum? Would you think, what the heck is foie gras? Or would you be surprised that I could be so insensitive as to serve you fatty, force-fed duck liver? Well, coming up at around 12:40 today, my second guest is Chicago Tribune veteran reporter Mark Caro, and the author of The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. He examines both sides of the story and will be joining us around 12:40 today. Quite a funny interview. I've actually seen him being interviewed. So we're going to look at both sides of the story and see what he has to say and see, you know, is it going to change your mind on what you think about foie gras? But first, despite many efforts to safeguard and restore our environment, we still see global damage across the board. We see ramifications of years of abuse and environmental apathy. If ever there was a time to consider the right relationship between humanity and environment, surely it's now. My first guest is, he believes that the Quaker principle of right relationship provides the solutions we need to balance economics and ecology. My guest is Jeffrey Garver. He's an environmental law and policy consultant in Montreal, Quebec. And Jeffrey's got such an impressive background that I can't disclose it all in the time we have here, but I do want to share with you a little of it so that you know that Jeffrey Garver is someone who actually lives what he speaks. He spent 7 years as the Director of Submissions on Enforcement Matters at North America's Commission for Environmental Cooperations. He directed the unit that manages breach associations in NAFTA policies. And prior to that, he spent 9 years with the U.S. Justice Department in the Environment and Natural Resources Division as a trial attorney. His major cases included suits dealing with the Everglades water quality, winter use and bison management in Yellowstone National Park, and water rights in Idaho and Oregon. And his latest work is co-authored with Peter Brown. It's called Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. Jeffrey Garver, welcome.
It's so nice to be with you today, Vicki.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. Some very interesting concepts in this book. But before we dive into some of the theories, I want to just take a look at how all of this came together. You were raised Quaker. You're still very active in the Quaker family, if that's the right terminology. Tell us how about the research project that ultimately led to this book.
Well, this book came together out of a project from a group called the Quaker Institute for the Future. And a group of Quaker economists and ecologists, people who had a professional relationship with some of the issues we talk about in the book, came together in Philadelphia, one of the main centers for Quakerism in the United States, to discuss their concerns about what the human economy was doing to the human prospect, our common future together on this finite planet. And they put together a group writing project, put out a call to people throughout the Quaker community to participate. And we had a series of weekend retreats, used Quaker process, which basically means having a lot of time for interaction, but also silent reflection, which is a big part of Quaker worship and Quaker process. Trying to reach unity or consensus on the matters we were talking about. So that was a really wonderful part of this experience, to not only put out a book on some issues that we think are very important today, but also to do that in community, in a group. And we hope the message that comes through is a stronger one because of that.
Yeah. Now, I want to just talk about a couple of terms that you use in the book and in some of the work that you've done, bearing witness as from a Quaker perspective, as I understand it, means just standing up for what we know is wrong and fighting for what we know is right. Is that correct?
Certainly can go along with that. Another way to think of it is really walking the talk.
Mm.
Is really living your life consciously and intentionally in a way that's true to the spiritual realities, the ethical realities, and as we really try to emphasize in this as well, the scientific realities, so that you're contributing to an earth that's in right balance and right. Right relationship between how we live and how we fit into the broader community of life.
Right. Now, and when you talk about wealth, we typically think monetary wealth. You're talking about everything that the earth provides that gives us wealth. Is that correct?
Yes. We think that the idea of wealth is reflected by money. Certainly, as we've seen in the last few years in this financial crisis we're in now, money making money on these sort of Ponzi-like schemes that have put our monetary wealth in so much jeopardy for so many of us, that's really gotten out of hand. We have to get back to thinking about wealth as ultimately the ability of the earth and its resources to provide for us. So we know that the earth, with its biocapacity, has a limited ability to provide everything that we consume, from the food we eat to the clothes we wear and so on, and also to assimilate or process the waste that we put back into it. And that includes not just the air and the water, but also the atmosphere, as we know right now with climate change being so much in the public discourse.
Mm. You raise five key questions in search of right relationship. Many of the activities that we are performing today, you say, are in wrong relationship. And this whole book examines, I'm going to let you tell it in your own word, but it, from my perspective, it examines what we're doing right now and how we can be doing it right. But tell us in your own words, how you describe the book.
Well, we tried not to focus too much on what's wrong, because there's a lot that's been written about that. There's some wonderful things, wonderful in that they're very honest, rigorous information about the ecological reality we're living with today. So, for example, ecological footprint researchers who are telling us that we're now consuming the earth and its resources at a rate that's faster than that they can regenerate, and that we've only been doing that for about the last 20 years. So throughout human history and human civilization, we've had an economy that's lived more or less within its means, and now we're in a new ecological reality. And it's happening in an era where economic growth and all of these impacts seem to be increasing at an exponential rate. We would love your listeners to take a look at our book. There's many others. One that I will mention is Gus Speth's recent book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, where he has a series of graphs showing increase in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, loss of biodiversity. You know, the rate of species extinction right now is 1,000 times greater than the natural rate. Things like the amount of paper we consume and the amount of water we consume, the amount of fertilizers we use, the loss in ocean fisheries, the number of fisheries that have gone into the fully exploited or overexploited territories in the 50s has gone from about 5% to 80%. So this is the reality that we see as reflecting wrong relationship at the global level. And a lot of this is a result of the way we run our economy, economy that assumes that all is well when GDP is going up and all is a disaster if it's going down. So we try to pose these questions about the economy that will reckon with this ecological reality and give us a path to what we call a whole earth economy, or economy that's really living within its ecological means.
So how does the economy work? You talk about this in the book. You say that we assume the earth is subsidiary to the economy. We measure wealth, money for itself, which we just kind of touched on. And we don't really think intelligently to the extent that we need to about economic activity, or what we typically call waste. So where do we begin with right relationship on how the economy works?
I think we have to first understand that our economy and our macroeconomics does tend to look like the earth and its resources as a limitless source of stuff to make what we consume out of, and a limitless sink for us to throw things away in. Now, we know just from the climate discussions and so many other things that that's not the case. But macroeconomics, the way it's designed, its models and theories, really has no rigorous way to incorporate that information. And so we're left with an economics that just assumes that in order for us to be able to make investments and reap a profit, or to have everybody employed, or everything else that seems essential to the economy, that we have to have GDP rising. Now,
gross domestic product we're talking about.
I should explain it. So it's certainly difficult not to do that. Because we're so entrenched in this kind of an economic way of thinking, it's very difficult to get out of that, and we realize that. But we say the starting point is, first of all, let's understand how the earth works physically. What are the biological and physical and chemical processes that underlie all of these processes that create what we're able to consume, and that break down the waste that we throw back into the environment, and all with an understanding that these processes are happening on a finite earth. The macroeconomic model, if you think of it as a sphere, an outer envelope that's just feeding off the earth and its resources under an infinite growth paradigm or model, that sphere is constantly getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, even though we're on a finite earth that is not getting bigger. And that's really the dilemma. So it starts with understanding basic physical concepts, a little bit of thermodynamics to remind us that we live on an earth that's closed to matter. Basically, all the physical stuff that's on this planet is not going to increase or decrease. Open to energy, because we have this wonderful resource called the sun that provides energy. But that drives photosynthesis, which is at the heart of the ability of the earth and its community of life to provide what we consume and to assimilate waste. And it's limited. I mean, that's really a central point of the book, and a lot of how that affects the economy flows from that basic concept.
It's important to understand that too, I think, before going forward. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jeffrey Garver. Together with Peter Brown, he co-authored the book Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
What a trip, just watching as the world goes by.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Thanks to its listeners, Alternative Talk 1150 has become the most refreshing talk radio in our area. Now we want to hear more from you. Log on to 1150kknw.com and take a brief survey. Besides helping improve your favorite station, you'll have a chance to win an overnight trip to Victoria, BC, courtesy of the Victoria Clipper. Log on now to 1150kknw.com to be heard and to have a chance at winning. Contest details posted online.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
How do you create lasting change in your life? How do you create lasting success, more happiness, and fulfillment? Actor Vanessa Williams says this: if you listen closely and apply Rob Mack's principles to your life, I know you'll achieve unprecedented success and happiness. Rob's insights and practical advice will not disappoint. Celebrity coach Robert Mack joins Vicky on Monday, June 29th for The Art and Science of Fulfillment. See program details at conversationslive.net or call Vicky at 800-495-7617.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest this segment is Jeffrey Garver. He wrote the book called Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And this book culminated after extensive research by a group of his colleagues. I wanted to just say, we were talking in the break, Jeffrey, and you were saying that this book really is a framework, and there are so many gnarly details, as you put to it. Do you think that, you know, using this as a starting point, that do you see, obviously you do see a better future if we follow this, right?
Well, I mentioned what's happening right now with climate change, and we mentioned this also in the book, that one opportunity, huge opportunity that's happening right now to put this model, this recognition of limits and putting constraints on the economy based on them, is happening right now with climate change. And when we talk about ecological footprint or use of biocapacity, the carbon footprint is a big part of that. It's a question of how many forests, for example, we'd have to plant in order to absorb all the our carbon without increasing the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, for example.
Mm.
So if we can get our act together at the national level, because, of course, this is a huge debate right now in the United States, how strong of a climate bill can we get it enacted, and then link that up with an international agreement that's very rigorously connecting policy approaches to what science is telling us about what the atmospheric limits of greenhouse gases can be without causing climate catastrophe, we're well on the way to adopting a model that can be applied in other ways. What's happened, unfortunately, consistently in the past is that as soon as the growth, economic growth, is threatened by any of this, then the environmental measures we back away from them.
Mm.
And the problem is that this is a huge gamble to take, given the environmental and ecological stakes that we're playing with. We really are at a point in history, based again by all this scientific reality, ecological reality, I described it at the beginning, of shaping an economy that reverses those priorities over growth over the environment, which is where we are now, with an environment not necessarily overgrowth, because if it's possible that we can grow and protect our atmosphere and protect our broader ecological base, well, that's great. But if we can't, then we have to start looking at what ecological economists and others are telling us about ways we can have either a negative growth economy or a steady state economy while still maintaining employment, still maintaining a sense of well-being among people and not causing panic, which is basically what happens whenever you have a tick down in gross domestic product now.
Right. Now, you talk in the book about how big is too big. Can an economy grow too big? Can it grow too fast? And, you know, currently you point this out that we have no measure, our current economy has no measure of enough, no means of showing when the negative effects of growth outweigh the benefits. So, but in right relationship, you talk about the planet having a thermostat. I wonder if you'd talk a little about that.
I'm sorry, having a
thermostat.
Thermostat. So some kind of mechanism that's saying that we need to slow down our consumption of things or consume things in a different way or change our waste patterns because we're consuming the ecological base of the Earth at a rate that's not truly sustainable. And certainly ecological footprint measures are that's not a perfect science right now. There are things about ecological footprint that are kind of overestimate our impact and other things that underestimate our impact. But overall, it's quite a good estimate of where we are in terms of whether the economy is too big. So the economy is too big when our footprint is too big. And what we know right now is that if everybody on the planet lived like an American, the average American, we would require 6 or 7 planets.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
It's amazing and scary. At the global level, we're it's about 1.5 planets that we're using for the one that we have. So there's a pretty big signal. The thinking of ecological economists, people like Herman Daly in the United States, or Peter Victor of Canada, who put out a terrific book called Managing Without Growth this year, it has really not broken into the economics mainstream. But it's high time that it does, so that we can have the best shot possible to a soft landing from not only economic crises, but the much more fundamental and in the long term much more important ecological crisis.
Mm. That's a good segue into your fourth question that you raise in the book, which is what's fair? And you say in a whole earth economy, fairness requires that we seek a flourishing earth, a world that works for all. How realistic do you really think that is, Jeffrey?
Well, yeah, this is, I guess, one luxury of writing a book like this is you focus on vision and maybe mm-hmm. put reality to the side. So at least we have a light at the end of the tunnel we're working for. There's no question that a lot of what we're calling for in this book is difficult. And but there's concepts that if we can agree on, at least maybe we'll move in the right direction. So fairness and that appeal there really calls upon some ethical notions that we've all grown up with, no matter what our religious, cultural, or ethical upbringing. Virtually every ethical tradition around the globe recognizes some form of the global rule, the golden rule, for example. And most of us, when we're young, learn that we shouldn't take more than our fair share. If you apply this to an understanding of the Earth as something limited, then you, I think, begin to understand that you're not the only person that has needs and access to this limited thing, but every other human does, every other living being does, and we can start adjusting our notions of fairness so that we create an Earth where, like you just said, every living thing has a fair chance.
Mm. Now, I know that from reading the book, you say that globalization of the economy is one of the worst things that's happened to our planet, to humanity, to the economy. How does that differ? How does globalization differ? And I know it's a very intricate chain of events here, but how does it differ on a high level to whole earth economy? What's the difference between globalization and whole earth economy if you had to, you know, put it in a nutshell?
Well, that's a very, very good question, Vicki. And I think when we talk about globalization, we're really talking about how it's done right now. So it's sort of globalization is really being run now in a Wild West kind of way by financial and development elites that are taking advantage, for example, of differentials in the amount of environmental protections different places on the earth have, different countries on the earth have, the labor standards, and so on. So there's a lot of exploitation going on, and there's our global trade regime has very little, very weak set of rules when it comes to environment, or certainly these notions of fair sharing a limited ecological base. So, in a whole earth economy, we would suggest there'd be a much more emphasis on local regions, whether that's at the national level or even smaller regional levels, are trying as much as possible to live within their environmental and ecological means. Now, one great example of something that's business oriented but is really moving in that direction is the whole green building movement. And you out in Seattle have a terrific chapter of the Green Building U.S. Green Building Council, the Cascadia chapter, is very active. And what that movement is doing, and it's not just LEED, which is the LEED, which is the U.S. Green Building Council, but all of the other rating systems that are used to rate green buildings and neighborhoods, they favor energy conservation, so reducing energy demand, and where you do have demand, favoring renewable energy as much as possible. They favor local sourcing of construction materials and reuse or recycling of materials. You know, they're moving towards an economic base that is much more place-based and not dependent on wide-ranging trade that has a lot of ecological impacts and is really playing off these disparities that are unhealthy, rather than trying to solve them in a healthy way.
Mm. Let's look at the European Union is actively working to some degree toward a whole earth economy. And let's look at what Obama's administration is doing right, or what we could learn from the European Union to develop this whole earth economy.
I think if one thing to understand about the European Union is that it started as an economic integration project. So back 50 years ago, what the countries in Europe were most interested in is kind of what we in North America were interested in starting about 10 or 15 years ago, well, 15 years ago with NAFTA. So the focus was on economic integration. And over time, Europe, on a Europe-wide basis, developed a set of environmental rules at a level that just doesn't exist, for example, in North America, in order to create a high level of environmental protection and also a fair playing field. So I think some of the ways that's been done in Europe could give us some lessons. They've also been very successful since the Kyoto Protocol was developed, even though Europe still has quite a high footprint at a global level. I mean, they're maybe half of the United States, but still more than one Earth's worth to support that level of living.
Mm-hmm.
Their ability to develop their economies while decreasing their ecological impact, in particular their greenhouse gas emissions, has been much better than in North America. And so, yeah, we suggest that there's something working in that kind of a federation that could have lessons for the rest of the world.
Yeah, you talk about that many of the government-supported activities that we're doing supposedly to actually help our economy, our environment, may be actually detrimental. And I'm thinking of, I think you gave biogenetically engineered food as an example, the production of diesel fuel as another example. Why, when we're told these are actually helping us be productive and you know, create a better planet, why do you think that's not true necessarily?
Well, I mean, one of the problems with biodiesel, of course, is, and maybe the most obvious one, is if we start using food crops to create fuel, we're changing the price structure for those food commodities at a time when there's many people around the world who are starving. It just seems like a gruesome thing to be doing. But we also, in terms of bioengineering and nanoengineering, there's just so many things we don't understand. Now, what you hear from those industries is that there's nothing's been proven harmful, but there's a lot of questions that really haven't been asked.
Sure.
About that. So much of this really calls for application of something like the precautionary principle. I mean, what happened with genetic engineering in the United States, I was first starting at the Justice Department. It was in the Reagan administration in the 80s, and there was no regulatory structure that really fit something like bioengineered food stuff. And or at that time, the question was, what's the regulatory structure that's going to apply to the first intentional releases of genetically engineered organisms into the environment? And that was a time where regulation was seen as a big bad thing, and there was no desire within that administration to develop a regulatory structure for it. So it just kind of happened, and that industry then had pretty much the green light to develop, to put in the investments to develop this whole industry. So by the time that it's kind of thrust upon us, it's, you know, the pressures to just go forward without a workable regulatory structure is kind of irresistible. And yeah. That's how I see what happened. And that's really too bad.
Yeah. A whole other show.
Yeah.
Huge topic all by itself, I think. We're coming to the end of the show. We've got about 5 minutes here, but I wanted to ask you, you know, given the state of the current economy as we know it and the job situation and, you know, that gap is getting wider between rich and poor people, what do we need to do to shift poverty, that reality of poverty?
Well, one thing I think is to have to think very broadly and with vision about what it means to be rich and poor, and to have a notion that it is possible to be too rich. I mean, just as our economy doesn't have a thermostat, many of us don't think we could possibly ever be too rich, but... And a way to think of that is why should people who have a lot of money have such a greater demand on the Earth's resources or ability to obtain the Earth's resources? So when we talk about fairness, a lot of that is, the thing about poverty right now is we probably do have enough resources that we could bring most people out of what we recognize as poverty. But another part of this is a much more deeper spiritual side of it, in that when we think we're living, it's more a notion of well-being. Mm-hmm. How do we improve well-being rather than poverty, and measure whether things are going well or not, not necessarily in terms of how much monetary wealth, but how much spiritual wealth we have, mm-hmm. Our ability, you know, how can you put a monetary value on the ability to gain joy and spiritual well-being from something that is absolutely free, whether that be a walk in your local park, whether it means engaging with your community in some way. Those are ways to bring people out of poverty. And of course, the challenges to do that in different parts of the world can be huge. There's so much of the world that's in violent conflict now, many different kinds of crises. But again, we're trying to put forward a vision here that hopefully appeals across many different traditions, many different nationalities, and is one that we can sort of collectively work towards.
A lot to think about. Jeff, what would be your call to action? What would you like to leave our listeners with today to start people thinking and maybe acting towards building a whole earth economy?
Well, other than checking out our book, which we would be delighted for people to do, there's some terrific resources on ecological footprint that really pose this question of what's my fair share in a nice way. I think our book will get people to think about that. Another one is a book by Jim Merkel called Radical Simplicity. It's really, when we talk about the steps toward a whole earth economy, it starts with grounding and clarification. And then, like we talked about at the beginning, bearing witness, walking the talk and feeling good about it. And hopefully that kind of thing will spread. At the same time, I do think we need much more regulation. We're kind of a regulation shy, especially in this part of the world, in the United States and Canada. We need rules that everybody's going to live by. People don't like to feel like suckers either, like they're the only people doing things.
Right.
And so, that calls for putting the right people in as our represented leaders.
And holding them accountable.
And holding them accountable, yep.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate being with us today. I know you were at a conference and took time out to be with us and talk about this today. And people can learn more about the book at your website, which is moraleconomy.org. That's correct, right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Moraleconomy.org. And my guest, Jeffrey Garver, his book, Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy, which he co-authored with Peter Brown. Jeffrey Garver, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Vicki.
And please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Chicago Tribune reporter Mark Caro in the foie gras wars.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Thanks to its listeners, Alternative Talk 1150 has become the most refreshing talk radio in our area. Now we want to hear more from you. Log on to 1150kknw.com and take a brief survey. Besides helping improve your favorite station, you'll have a chance to win an overnight trip to Victoria, BC, courtesy of the Victoria Clipper. Log on now to 1150kknw.com to be heard and to have a chance at winning. Contest details posted online.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk Podcast Reviews, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk Podcasts today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
1150kknw.com, your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Mark Caro. He's a longtime reporter for the Chicago Tribune. His writing on the foie gras controversy received honors from the James Beard Foundation and the Association of Food Journalists. I think his new book title says it all. The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know what? If somebody had told me I was going to read a whole book and that I would enjoy it on foie gras, I would not have believed them.
Well, that's very funny. I mean, you know, I write about entertainment for the Chicago Tribune, and if someone had told me that you're going to finally write a book and it's going to be about fat duck livers, I wouldn't have believed them either. So we're even.
So tell us how it got started. It got started, you are an entertainment reporter, as you just said. You
Correct.
Were interviewing, I believe, Charlie Trotter.
Yeah, Charlie Trotter, who's one of the top chefs out here in Chicago, if not the country. And I'd gotten a tip that he had quit serving foie gras, and I occasionally branched beyond doing the strict entertainment stuff. And I was interested in this, and I wanted to know. I'd had foie gras a few times and thought it was very tasty, but I also knew that there was some controversy behind it. And so I talked to him about it, and he said that he quit serving it because he just wasn't comfortable with how it was produced, which involves the force feeding of a duck or a goose. And I called other chefs in Chicago, and the other top chefs here, some French ones, they said, no, I've seen it done, and it really isn't so bad. And one chef, Rick Tremonto, at the restaurant True, which is a real rival of Trotter's here, he said, look, it's kind of hypocritical. Either you're raising animals to kill them and eat them, or you're not. And I told Trotter this quote, and he's like, well, Rick can't be that dumb, is he? I mean, just because you raise an animal to kill it and eat it doesn't mean they should have to suffer. It's just kind of an idiot comment. Maybe we should serve up Rick's liver for a little treat. It's certainly fat enough. And so all of a sudden, I had the two top chefs in Chicago, and one of them threatening to eat the other one's liver. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I think you just put the story on the front page. And it could have just been sort of a jokey thing, but I did more research into it, and the thing that struck me was I thought both of their points of view actually made a lot of sense. That on one hand, you don't want to make animals suffer unduly, but on the other hand, where do you draw the line? And if you're saying you this is bad, then what about what we eat every day? And as it turned out, foie gras had been a controversy already in California. They'd already banned it at the end of 2004, but it doesn't go into effect until 2012.
Well, I wanted to ask you, how come it doesn't go into effect till 2012?
Well, this is the thing. And part of, again, a lot of the book isn't really just about fat duck livers. It's about people, and it's about governments and what people do in governments and how legislation gets passed. And in a way, a lot of it is just how the duck sausage gets made. And in California, there are only three foie gras farms of any scale in the whole country, and only one of them is in California, and it's Sonoma Foie Gras. And Guillermo Gonzalez there was getting buried in lawsuits there, among other things, charging cruelty to animals and that sort of thing. And the political forces were against him in California, and he basically agreed to go along with the ban if he got a grace period of 7.5 years and also was indemnified from all of these lawsuits.
So he
went along with it, figuring, well, he had that much time to convince people that what he's doing isn't cruel or find something else to do. So, of course, it's this ticking time bomb now where, they're getting closer. And actually, this has been flaring up a lot in California, where the city of San Francisco just passed an ordinance saying that they would, which the mayor signed, saying that they would commend any restaurant that took foie gras off its menu. And so it's been a real political hot-button issue. But it really is a wedge issue in this greater battle, which is whether you should eat meat or not.
Mm. So you started your research on this, and you do point out that we've been fattening geese and now ducks since the days of the pharaohs.
Right.
Is it the method that is causing the controversy?
Yeah, I mean, it's just this idea that we have, and it's a reasonable idea, in theory that the idea of force feeding an animal makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And the idea of taking this tube and sticking it down, a duck's throat, people say, oh, that's horrible. And imagine if this was done to you. And just the visual of it is such, if you go on YouTube or something, you watch the visuals, it just makes you want to gag. Ducks and geese are, in fact, different from us. They also swallow whole fish live. They breathe through a different part. They breathe from under their tongue, so they're not it's not cutting off their windpipe. They have harder esophaguses than we do, so they're able to swallow stuff. And there are various studies that say that they're, in fact, not getting damaged by this at all. There are other studies that say, well, they're getting damaged in horrible ways, and it's really hard to sort of sort out what the different people say about it. But it's not, it's the kind of thing where your average person says, oh, foie gras, I won't eat it because it's torturous to ducks. But mm-hmm. when you actually see it done at a place like Hudson Valley Foie Gras, for instance, which is the biggest in the country, the ducks don't really react. And then that becomes sort of a source of controversy, too, because you watch it and you say, look, the ducks that just got fed, the ducks that haven't got fed yet, it takes, you know, a few seconds each time. They don't really react. You can't tell the ones that just got fed. And then, you know, at the same time, you'll have animal rights people say, well, look, ducks are prey animals, so they don't show you that they're suffering, but they're really suffering. How could they not be suffering? Because their livers are swelling up to like 8 to 10 times their normal size.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but at the same time, nobody wants to think about what's being done to manipulate the chickens that you eat, or the beef that you eat, or the pig, or the eggs that are laid. I mean, everything that we eat is manipulated to some extent, and people don't want to know about that. But at the same time, they're willing to give up foie gras because it's expensive and it's French and it's something that, you know, foodies eat, and it's, you know, and it's something that most people do not eat. And so it's sort of an easy issue for people to take a big stand on without really putting much of themselves on the line.
Well, do any of the ducks that you saw, do any of them voluntarily go up to that tube to be fed?
I didn't see. You know, it's funny. You'll hear both sides of it. You'll hear they actually flock to the feeders with their beaks wide open, and I never saw that. But I also didn't see what I've seen described on the other side, which is that their wings are all broken and they're staggering on their swollen bodies to get desperately away. They don't. Mm. You know, I mean, if I reached down and grabbed for my cat, you know, who's a wonderful purry cat, she would still, you know, move away, you know, a lot of the time when I'm reaching down. Ducks don't like to be grabbed, and so there's some measure of avoidance there. But the ones that have been in this, it's basically a 2.5-week period usually, maybe 3 at Hudson Valley. The ones that have been in this process longer actually have less avoidance of the feeder than the ones that have just gotten moved in there because they've been outside or in these large barns and have had a lot more personal space. But there's nothing conclusive from looking at it that makes you think, oh, this is it. Now, again, there are people who have lots of evidence on either side, which you can judge from. And it's interesting with the book because people read the book and some of them say, wow, this really convinces me that foie gras is okay. And other people say, wow, this convinces me that I'm never going to eat it again.
Right.
And
well, that's a testament to how well you put your argument. I mean, you've really stayed pretty neutral in it.
Well, I try to, you know, I don't pretend that I'm not in it. You know, I definitely inject myself in terms of asking pointed questions and giving my impressions. But I also don't, I think my job is to tell you what I learned, not to tell you what to think. And so, you know, I'm trying to be honest with my reactions, but I'm also trying to let you, because I'm not going to tell you that you have to quit eating meat or not eat, you know, eat this or not eat that, because these are very personal questions, and it's something that I wrestle with myself all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm someone who does try to think of animal ethics, but I'm also not a vegetarian and certainly not a vegan. And to a lot of people, if you're not a vegan, then you believe in exploiting animals. And I understand that argument, and I have some sympathy to it, while at the same time I'm also critical of, you know, some of the tactics that are used, just because I think that, you know, everyone should be more upfront in general. And I think that in a way this is something that maybe both sides would agree on, that if it just would be better if people just sort of knew more and there was more transparency and you sort of weren't having everything be based on these kind of emotional arguments.
Yeah, then we could make more informed decisions, I think. You point out that 500,000 ducks approximately are used for foie gras, plus there are other body parts. And versus
right, in the U.S.
Yeah, versus 9 billion chickens. 9 billion.
Yeah.
But I won't say nobody. But there's less emphasis on chickens being abused. I didn't know this until I read your book, and you didn't either.
No, I didn't. There are all sorts of things I didn't know
that male chicks, once they're out of their eggs and sexed, if they're born into a laying farm, that male chicks are snuffed out, as you put it.
Exactly.
I did not know that.
A lot of debate on how humanely that's done, which I don't get into, but the fact is, I mean, it's interesting to me, and this is something I didn't realize, which is just that the animal rights movement is really much more about suffering than lifespan. And so, and obviously they have to pick their battles, but the idea that, you know, when you buy an egg, you know, half of the chickens that were, you know, being bred to lay these eggs are just being snuffed out when they're a day old because they're the wrong sex. To me, that was really startling. I'm like, wait a minute. But that's just the industry, because it's not to anyone's economic advantage to raise those chickens. And it's not like I have some brilliant idea of what to do with those chickens, but I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that, you know, as controversial as foie gras is, you know, I was able to go to two of the three major farms in the U.S., and then there's one smaller one, very small one in Minnesota I went to too, and also these other ones in France, and I was able to see how it's done. I mean, I went to about 10 foie gras farms doing this book, but if you asked to go to see where your chicken comes from, the stuff that really everyone eats, which would you would think would be more important to be transparent, forget it. You know, you can't do any of that.
Yeah, interesting. And many of the farmers that you did meet, and they're actually small, pretty small farms, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a whole argument about, for instance, Hudson Valley, because that one's bigger than the other two, and they have something, I don't know, 200,000 to 300,000 ducks a year. And you know, people at Farm Sanctuary and some of the groups say, look, this is an industrial farm. And in fact, that farm is bigger than any of the individual farms in France. France produces a lot more foie gras than we do here, but it's more the system of small farms, like hundreds of farms feeding into one producer, Rougier being one of them, where I saw, you know, livers on conveyor belts at the factory. So there's a debate on whether it's, you know, a factory farm or not. So, that, I mean, that's a pretty sizable farm, but it's not as big as, you know, again, what, you know, if you go down south, one of these big chicken plants or something.
Yeah. Now, your article led to foie gras being banned in Chicago, but then that was repealed, wasn't it? So nobody can make up their mind on this situation.
No, and that's kind of fun. Part of the funny thing about this, and that Joe Moore, this alderman on the north side of Chicago, read my article without doing any other research, proposed next week that the city of Chicago ban it, and some months later they had some hearings in the health committee, and they brought in Loretta Swit, who played Hot Lips in MASH.
Right.
And she compared the treatment of the ducks to the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. And it becomes a sort of theater of the absurd, and it passed out of the committee, but they waited 6 months to bring it to a vote in Chicago, and it finally was tucked into this thing called the Omnibus Bill, which is basically where thousands of people, pieces of legislation each month are put in. It's basically a street sign is changed or something like that. So there was never any debate about it, so it went through almost unanimously. Then the city was called out on it, and it became, you know, and the Mayor Daley was calling it the silliest ordinance that they ever passed. And then 2 years later, they reversed themselves. But nobody really learned any more about the treatment of ducks. It was like they did it as a favor to this one alderman to get it through the first time. And then when they were embarrassed, they just got rid of it because they were embarrassed. But, you know, to me, it's just fascinating to see how laws actually are passed, because you realize it's not just this one. It's many in Chicago. And here in the city now, we have this whole debate over the parking meters, because they passed something very quickly where they privatized all our parking meters.
Oh.
And then quadrupled the, you know, how much you have to pay to park, you know,
right,
just in street parking. And it, you know, it's like you see how government works.
Yeah.
And again, the book is meant to be entertaining. It's like, if you're going to write a book about duck livers, it better be enjoyable to read, because otherwise, why would anyone put themselves through it, and why would I put myself through it to write it? And they're really interesting people and, you know, characters on, you know, both sides of it. And it's just, to me, it's just fascinating to get all these different ideas in there and points of view, and, you know, there are a lot of valid points, again, on both sides of the argument. And to me, it was like sort of moral whiplash I'd go through, where you'd hear one side and you'd say, yeah, that's interesting, but then you hear the other and go, that's a good point too.
Yeah, I definitely, because I had definitely stopped eating foie gras quite a while ago, but I could see both sides of the fence when I was reading your book. Do you still eat foie gras yourself?
It's not something I'm making an effort to do, but I'm not going to say that I've made a principled stand against it, because I haven't, you know, banned other things that, you know, probably worse. I mean, if I had
right.
the choice of being reincarnated, and I'm not the first one to say it, but if I could be a foie gras duck or a, you know, commercial chicken, I think I'd choose the duck. You know, at least you get to be outside for a bit, or at least you get to, I mean, you live longer. I care about longevity. So, yeah, I mean, I've joked to someone that if I'd written a book about brownies, I probably wouldn't be eating a lot of brownies either. And it's not like I could afford to eat a lot of foie gras. I've been at some events where I've been served it, and it's been fine. But I sort of did enough of the foie gras while I was working on the book. But I'm not going to say, you know, I'm never going to eat it, or I'm not eating it as a principle, because I haven't drawn that line with other things that I think are probably worse.
Yeah. Well, Mark Caro, thank you so much for being with us. The book was very well written. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Oh, just that I'll be in Seattle on the 14th of July at this Words and Wine event. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to being out there. And it's, you know, eat and read ethically and enjoy both.
Okay, well, if you send me the link to where you are coming, we'll put it on our website and we'll remind listeners closer to the date.
That'd be fantastic.
Thank you, Mark, for being with us. And my guest, Mark Harrow, his book, The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. And is Mark still with us?
Yes.
Yeah, what's your website, Mark? I forgot to ask.
MarkCaro.com.
MarkCaro.com.
Or FoieGrasWars.com.
There you go. Just type in foie gras and Mark. Everything will pop up. All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for being with us today. We will be back next week. And if you have chance, check out our Book Talk podcast at conversationslive.net. And if you have suggestions for future books, please, or for review, please let me know. You can find me at vicky@conversationslive.net or at 800-495-7617. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
How do you create lasting change in your life? How do you create lasting success? More happiness and fulfillment. Actor Vanessa Williams says this: if you listen closely and apply Rob Mack's principles to your life, I know you'll achieve unprecedented success and happiness. Rob's insights and practical advice will not disappoint. Celebrity coach Robert Mack joins Vicky on Monday, June 29th for The Art and Science of Fulfillment. See program details at conversationslive.net or call Vicky at 800-495-7617. Stronger.